Paul speaks to the elders of Ephesus and he says to them, keep watch over yourselves, before he says that they must keep watch over the flock. And then Paul writes to Timothy and he says there too, pay attention to your life, watch your life and doctrine, but I'm focusing on life. And I looked at several areas and I'd like to continue this morning. And this next point is a longer point, but it's pay careful attention to the many temptations which face us, could face us. We need to be alert to the lurking dangers. We need to be on our guard. We need to be aware of some of the potholes or the pitfalls. And so some of them are temptations, some of them are dangers. I'm going to be mixing the words there. But again, let's have open hearts. And I think not only that we, first of all, primarily need to listen with the ear and open to the Spirit for ourselves, but these are also things that we need to bring into our leadership and churches, reminding us. I think I said it yesterday, that is that I've heard much of what I know, I've heard time and time and time again. But there have been those moments that it felt like I'd never heard it before, because it was then relevant in my life. I've been to many, 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 many sessions with Dudley, and there were times that I thought, I'm not going to learn anything new. Dudley repeats and repeats a lot of the things. But I heard things, but the penny never dropped. And so also with this morning, I'm not going to say much that is new, I don't think. But it may be new for you in your situation, for me in my situation today. So what are those temptations that could be lurking? The temptation to compare oneself with others. I suppose it depends on what you are like as a person. If you are very confident, self-confident, if you are very sure of yourself and what you've done up until this point, if you are somebody that's a little bit thick-skinned, those type of people don't seem to worry about what others think. But if you are a little hesitant, if you are a little introvert, if you are, depending on your background as well, how you've been brought up, you're not so sure if what you're doing is the right thing, those type of people have the tendency to compare oneself. And so we compare ourselves with those that are stronger than us, those who seem to do it better than us, those that have better gifts of speaking, communicating, singing, leading a meeting, or whatever the case may be. And so it is a real danger. If we compare ourselves with people who are worse than us, in inverted commas worse, they do it worse than us, they're not as good as us in our own eyes, then we could have the tendency to become proud. But if we're in the other category, we can become more insecure and we could feel that we are failing and we could lack then courage, faith, and even influence. And so we need to guard against comparing ourselves. Now, I think that there's an element that is healthy in comparing, just so that we can learn from. But I'm talking about that comparison where we are either better than or worse than the person. And I think we all go through phases like that. I hear sometimes Dutch people and even ministers, and they're not, you know, in the category that I would want to put myself in as far as their theology and that is concerned. But if I hear them sometimes with the use of the Dutch language, then I wish that I could communicate like that. And then I respond by saying, I'm doing my best, and I want to learn where I can still learn and improve. But if I were to say, oh, I will never be able to overcome this thing or that thing because my Dutch is like it is, even my English, I was never, you know, the best at that either. But I can communicate in more than one language. And so I say, at least I can do that. So comparing oneself, be alert, be wise. And especially when you tend to be a little depressed or things are going a little worse, not as well as you had experienced them before, the danger to compare oneself with others. The second thing of the dangers is the temptation to want to impress others. And we do that in many different ways. We can embellish the truth. We can exaggerate. We can tell stories as if we were part of the story when in fact we had nothing to do with it. We can give a CV that is more colorful than it really is. We can name drop. We can use big words. We can use the Greek and the Hebrew. Come and share that you know the word chesek. That wasn't the case.
I'm learning, Kurt.
No. But you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Is that we can impress. There are so many different ways because you may have the need to feel that you need to come across more than who you are. But you know, it may work for a little while, but people will see through it after a while. And that has to do with our integrity, that has to do with being real, being authentic. So be careful that we don't try and impress. I think it's not wrong to tell stories, it's not wrong. I use also the Greek and the Hebrew, but I also am quick to acknowledge that my knowledge is very limited. So let's be wise and careful. The next thing is the temptation to want to promote oneself. I was reminded of it by someone, and then I went back to find the piece of the film which I ever once saw, one of the Shrek. I don't think I saw more than Shrek movies. As I said, I'm a Christian. I have to lay aside those things which can so easily entangle us in the race that we're running. I'm going home with him, eh? So I've still got a bit of time to work on him. Yeah, I think we're going to be watching movies from this afternoon. But in that one Shrek movie, he was going to go somewhere and he had a mission and he wanted somebody to go with him, and then he says, who will go with me? And then the donkey says, pick me, pick me, pick me. And I thought that's a good example of sometimes people, how they promote themselves. You know, you must have all experienced that somebody comes new into your church and immediately gives his or her CV. I was a home group leader in our church. I was an elder in our church. I even led worship in our church, and I'm available. You know, I'm God's answer to your needs here in the church. I don't bring it that way, but... So we all know that type of thing, but how's it going with us? How we promote ourselves, how we try and justify. It's linked with that impressing others, but we need to guard against that. Humility is the opposite of wanting to promote ourselves. Then we have the I don't know what to call it, but I've put here the desire or the need to be accepted and affirmed. And so where we can say things, where we can tell a story, where sometimes we can make it more dramatic or more sad or whatever, because we want people to accept us. We want people to affirm us. I love it when once in a while, after you've been preaching in your church, to hear that there are people that are still happy that you're there. I think we all enjoy that in a way, that because we need that. And I think that's why the Bible also says encourage one another daily. So it's part of that affirmation. But as we all know, that there are periods when you don't have any of that and you've got to be affirmed. Like someone mentioned, yeah, David strengthened himself in the Lord. We've got to be affirmed because we know God has called us. We know that we can respond to God and say, God, I'm doing what you want me to do. And that, well done, my faithful servant. This is my son in whom I'm well pleased. We need to have that. But the danger is that when we haven't had it for a while, we can do or say things, if we're preaching or leading a group or whatever, whereby we, is the right word, solicit a response. And we have that because we want to be affirmed. I think that we can, most of us can learn to be better encouragers. And if we sow that culture, we will also reap that culture. But we mustn't sow it because we want it. And so we need to be wise. You know, as I said, it's necessary. I remember one time, Leon was always very positive, and in the beginning of the years when I preached, when he wasn't there, he obviously didn't hear it and so forth. And you do always wonder, when you're not the lead guy, am I doing what was expected of me and so forth? And I had a lot of space. I mean, I did a lot of other teaching and that. But Leon is an encourager and always finds something positive to say. So again, I'm grateful for that influence in my life, because I try and live that out. But I remember one time I was in Germany at one of the early equips, and I was asked to do one of the sessions. And it was, as I said, in the beginning of my doing that type of thing. And Leon, among others, was in the audience. And I preached, and then it's with translation. And so English into German. I can follow German, so I try and also hear. Have to concentrate, don't listen, and correct. I was in Dresden, and I was struggling. And when I was finished, I was just wishing that the platform would open up and swallow me. That's how I felt. And we all know that. I mean, it's not just once I've had that feeling. But what happened was that somehow in me, I thought, well, my gauge, I will know if my gauge was right or not by what Leon will say. And that particular day, Leon walked from that corner of the room where he was, and he walked past me and never said anything. And I went home to the hotel. It was still the old Kim Hotel, I think it was called. And that night, I didn't sleep. I felt, how do I face the people? What do they think of me? All that went through my head. The next morning, Debbie asks, how do you sleep? I'm not a good sleeper, but Debbie asked me, and I said, it was terrible. I said, I don't want to go back. Why? And then she said, I mean, as I said yesterday, the wives often sit there hearing things differently. And so anyway, the rest of the thing, I don't know when it was, but there was I don't know if it was in that week, but it was later, even maybe telephonically when Leon was back in Australia. I told him this incident. And then Leon said, Gert, I'm so sorry. I thought it was great, but just the circumstances was, you know, I was vulnerable to him. I said, Leon, you know, this is what happened. And because this is the one time you never said anything I interpreted that you thought also what I was thinking. So why am I telling you this? Oh, yes, the need to be affirmed and accepted. I'm grateful that there are people that come afterwards and they give you a clap on the, what do you say in English?
Slap on the back.
Slap on the back. And we need to be that as well. And you know, I felt for guys sometimes while they are doing something, maybe leading a prayer meeting or whatever, and I feel it's not going so well for this guy. You have that, or the worship leader or whatever. I've tried to learn how I can say thank you or give them a slap on the back that even just says thanks that you stepped onto the mark. You took your place. So you don't have to lie. You don't have to say that was great. But thanks for taking the ball. I passed the ball to you. You took it. Okay, you didn't shoot it into the goal. But he knows. You don't have to tell him that. He knows that. So it's two ways here. We mustn't go and look for all those compliments and constantly need to, because leaders that constantly need to be told you're accepted and you're a good guy and whatever, that's not healthy. On the other hand, we must sow it by realizing that some of our people can also feel very vulnerable. How do we help them and teach them? So, okay, I've said more than I intended. The temptation to compromise is the wanting to adjust the message to avoid possible criticism. We adjust our message, and I'm not talking about the message of preaching, but our message, our conviction or whatever. We compromise because we want to avoid possible confrontation. Another reason why we compromise is because of fear of rejection. So those things we need to deal with. I do think that we need to find ways, and some people more than others, in which we can bring truth without wanting to offend. We need to find ways of bringing the truth. Also, what I learned from Leon is that if you've got 10 tons of correction that you need to bring to somebody, you need to have a bridge that can carry 11 tons. He didn't add that last piece. That's my addition. The bridge must be a bit stronger than the load that you're going to carry across. There needs to be that relationship. And then the way, you know, you can come up to somebody and say, you stupid fool, why did you do that? And this is what the Bible says, and you've been, or you can come in a very different way. And so we can compromise on the one end to avoid all those things. On the other hand, some people need to learn to be wiser and warmer and more fatherly and motherly when they do come. The temptation to make people feel guilty or condemned. In the beginning years, or not in the beginning, but after a number of years when we were in the church in 4000, we started renting a building, and they still use that. It's the building that we rented for during the week activity. So we rented it on a permanent basis. But it needed everything done to it. That's why when I saw the building in Aberdeen, my heart sank, because I'm a practical guy. I can do a lot of the things, and I just saw all the potential that a small church like that took on itself. And we had this project, and in the beginning everybody was enthusiastic, and we had working Saturdays and people came. Eventually it lasted 2 years, and there were two of us working there every Saturday and my days off. And our families, even our children, we brought them when we had to paint and fill all the holes for the plasterboards and everything, and so forth and so forth. But there was a phase that I was getting frustrated because the people had lost their enthusiasm and being participating in it. And it started coming through my preaching. And I began to realize it. Through my preaching, unintentionally, but I was frustrated and I was irritated, and I was especially frustrated with people that had committed themselves, or people that want to serve and everything but don't do it. Through my preaching, people were beginning to feel guilty. We can do it in other ways. And sometimes we can have a strong conviction. Sometimes we can be aware that there's some issues. There are some issues. There may be even sin. But using the pulpit to make people feel guilty. And I'm not talking about once or so saying something that afterwards you realize you shouldn't have said it because, but I'm talking about systematically bringing things whereby we make the people feel guilty. And I know that this happens. People want to leave the church. You can make them feel guilty that they're going to come under the judgment of God. I know that. I know it's true. I've heard it. So we need to watch that temptation, especially when we're frustrated, especially when we're irritable, especially when you're dealing with somebody that just does not want to listen. The next one is the temptation to paint everyone with the same brush. I had to learn as a married man and married young, I had to learn that the church does not just exist of married couples. And so a lot of the illustrations you use are family orientated, but they are singles and they are divorced people. And then in our church now, we have a number of people that have been divorced before and remarried. And then they've got, in some country I heard it was called, they're called patchwork families. So I had to learn and make adjustments to think. And sometimes I make a note, single, divorced. So that you don't just use the illustration of marriage. But that's not so negative, but other times it can be that, you know, they're stubborn, they're lazy, they're not wanting to work on their marriage, and so we paint the whole church with that same brush. And it takes wisdom. And as we grow older, when you're young and less experienced, as I was, I look back and I say the grace of God saw me through. And it was the grace of God that people kept coming. But if you're open and willing to learn, I think that's what the heart that God looks at and people look at. So let's be careful that we don't paint everybody with the same brush. The next temptation I've got is throwing in the towel, wanting to give up. Now again, as I said yesterday, I think that you people don't know what that means. Because the blessing of the Lord is so on your lives that you never have those moments. But again, I'm sure there's not one person sitting in the room here that hasn't had that after maybe the message, after having led your home group or leading the home group, and there's just no breakthrough. Criticism that comes over us. I've had many Mount Carmel experiences in my life, although I've never had that unique and amazing experience that Elijah had on the mountain. I've never encountered that fire coming from God and, you know, all the oxen that I'd slain lying there and that and poured all the water in Holland over it and then, phew. I've never experienced things like that, nothing like that. But I've had mountaintop experiences, which I call mountaintop experiences. And yet I also know the experience that we tend to forget that happened in chapter 19 of 1 Kings, where Elijah runs away because of the threat of a woman called Jezebel. And he runs, was it 40 days into the wilderness? And then he says, God, he goes and sits under a broom tree and he says, God, I want to die. I'm giving up. I'm throwing in the towel. And I felt this morning, I felt it could be that one or more of you this morning are sitting at that point. It's been a slog. You know the mountaintop experience. You can't tie the thing together. but just last week, last year, it was so great, and God came down, and there was fire in a different way then, but all of this, and now you're running, and you're saying, God, I want to die. I want to die. I don't think I said it literally like that, but I have said, Lord, I don't mind if you take me home. So I didn't use the words in a negative way because I didn't want to the Lord to take me seriously. But I felt that. I've had times when I felt that. And I remember we made the bed together, Debbie on the one side of me, and we made the bed together. And I sort of patted my bed and I said, I'm coming back just now. Because I wanted to come back just now because... I'm not a very good sleeper, and especially in a phase like that, you don't sleep well. But I knew that when you're sleeping, all those things are gone. I'm not a depressed type of person, but I know that people can have depression and suffer, and maybe spiritual depression. So I want to say to you this morning, maybe you're running towards that desert. You cannot explain it. You're struggling with a feeling. This is not me, and yet I'm feeling this way. And I want to say, acknowledge the reality of those feelings. And as you're running and sitting under that tree, say, God, meet me like you met Elijah. And then, you know, the amazing thing is that Elijah goes and sits under that tree and falls asleep. God causes him to sleep. And the reason was because he needed sleep. He was tired. And so, take your sleep. And then, God organizes him a big barbecue. I'm amazed at the details. That this was prepared for him. You know, this is the Elijah that not only had the Carmel experience, but he went in obedience to the brook Cherith. And then, wasn't there also a lady that was used to supply him with food after the brook dried up? I'm confusing the two. But anyway, there is something like that. And then he has this mountaintop experience. And now he's there. And God lets him sleep. And sleep. And sleep as long as that is necessary. And that sounds very unspiritual. That we need sleep. But sometimes we need sleep. We need rest. Extended like that. And so then God gives him this meal. And then the thing that struck me years ago, when I was busy with this, studying this episode in the Bible there, then God gives him a new commission. And so I also want to say, instead of throwing in the towel, while you're running to your broom tree or your broom cupboard and you're wanting to lock yourself away, allow God to minister to you with sleep, with angels bringing you food, whatever the case may be, and the angels can be in the form of people bringing you meals or whatever the case may be. But then also be open to God maybe saying, there's a new season that I've got for you. And then God gives him a commission. Go and anoint this guy, go and anoint that, go and tell them this. And so his whole ministry changes. And so we can be negative, and sometimes I or you can be negative towards those people that are going through such a phase instead of helping them to also come to the place where they can say, well, Lord, maybe you've got a change of plan for the direction that I'm going in. And it was very positive for him. So you may be at your wit's end in what you're doing. Maybe you're leading a home group, maybe being an elder. Yesterday I spoke about the importance of knowing that this is what God wants me to be doing. And although I believe that it's a calling and it's not just a temporary calling, for most of us it's a life calling, the reality is that for some, it may not be a life calling. I'm grateful for the guy who started the church that I'm now leading and invited me to come and lead. He wasn't an elder, lead man. He's not so, he definitely wasn't a lead man, but an elder in any other situation, I'm not sure that he would have become. But he started the church and he led it all those years. And when he came to me after 2 years of me being there and said, I feel now's the time to stop, I felt it was right. But in the transition, I felt he needed to stay on the eldership. for the stability of the process. And maybe that was his desert moment. And so we need to recognize that God could change plans because he doesn't always give us all the details for the rest of our lives. So I want to encourage you, don't always see that as negative. But see it as a moment where God gets your attention, replenishes your energy, your strength. And see. So I'm not saying now just because it's been a difficult period that all of you must think that's the end of that season, another one coming. But the temptation to want to throw in the towel. Then there's the temptation to be totally absorbed in one's own ministry and forgetting the bigger picture. I remember there was a phase in Cornerstone when I was there that I had to oversee the ministry of the praise and worship and that. And some of you may say, sure, how did they give that to you? Anyway, I got that responsibility, and it was in the early days, and I went with the musicians. I don't play an instrument. I can keep a fairly good tune or the melody, but I'm not a singer. But I went with them to workshops, and Malcolm, Mally Duplessis, and all those. We went to halfway down to Durban, a place called Oban was the first place where we met. And the musicians then went with the group because that's what we encouraged. And then I came back. And every time I came back from something like that, I was very enthusiastic and worked together with the musicians because they were enthusiastic, was there at the practices, helped to build team and so forth and so forth. And I then realized that they needed some more money and that. So in the elders meeting, I would come and I would. So a lot of the things that I spoke about when I went to the eldership meetings was the ministry that I was involved in. I had other responsibilities, but that was going nicely and people were responding and so forth and so forth. And then one day Leon spoke to me and he says, "Gert, I'm very grateful for what you're doing and it's wonderful to see what is happening, but there's more happening in Cornerstone. And you're excited about your ministry, but not so excited about the others and their ministries." Ow. Ow. Do we do these things intentionally? No, most of us not. But we can be so absorbed with this that I need money. Now, I know that the ministry, I mean, we jokingly often say about the sound guys, they always need more money. When they come, they say, "Here's our list, we always need more. We always need." So, but the Sunday school can also come and say, "We need more money." And I try and help our people to realize, look, it's one big jigsaw puzzle, and every part is a piece in the puzzle. And as important as your ministry is for the whole, it is part of the whole. And so we need to realize, and you may be an elder, you may be a home group leader, you may, and your ministry, God is blessing it, and you think, sure, the other ministries in the church are very dry, but God is really blessing us. And that may be true. But remember, we're part of the bigger picture. And that can also be with our local church. Focus so on our own ministry there that we forget. You know, when we begin to also inquire about how's it going with you and what is happening with your ministry and what are the struggles that you're facing, we're also going to become bigger in our thinking, well, perhaps we can send some or two workers there. So let's not be so absorbed with our own ministry, as important as that ministry may be. And then there's the temptation of self-sufficiency and pride. Being an individualist instead of a team player. Charles Swindoll says that one does not become proud when you are dependent on God. Pride happens when everything is going your way. When you've just won that battle, when you've just received that promotion, when you've just clinched that deal. Pride happens when you look back and you can see an almost spotless record. Or when you see that you are growing in significance and prestige and fame. We think of David, a man after God's own heart, servant-hearted leader, the greatest king of Israel, And yet there was a phase in which we see that he became self-sufficient and proud. And it started, there are three things that I notice. The first problem is that David became overambitious. Remember when he said, go to Job, go through the nation and all the tribes of Israel from Dan to Beersheba and number the people that I may know the number of the people. And it wasn't what God wanted. But he had now time on his hands because he had been successful. And so now just to check the results that we have scored. And then, I don't know, but I think because of what we see, how God responds to that, that David wanted to learn the strength of his army so that maybe he could boast. The second problem is that David was out of touch with God. See, when we're no longer dependent on God, when we so desperately need God, the chances of becoming proud are minimal. But when he lost touch with God, he did not seek and pray for God's counsel. And yet one of the things, I did a study on David, one of the things is how often we read, and David sought the Lord, and David asked the Lord for advice, that type of thing. And now comes the phase when he's actually got to the place where God said he would come, king of all of Israel. And now he loses touch with God. And he makes decisions based on his experience, his intuition, instead of inquiring of the Lord. And self-sufficiency causes us not to seek God's counsel because we think we can do it ourselves. And the third problem is that he became unaccountable to those around him. Joab warned David in 2 Samuel 24, verse 3. Joab said to his king, may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of my lord the king still see it. But why does my lord the king delight in doing this thing? But the king's word prevailed against Joab and the commanders of the army. So Joab and the commanders of the army went out from the presence of the king to number the people of Israel. Joab, I'm the king. Don't speak against me. Don't rebel. Go and count the people. No longer accountable. Fortunately, the story has another, and this story also has a positive ending in chapter 2, verse 24. In chapter 24, verse 20, we read, but David's heart struck him after he had numbered the people. And that's what made David the man after God's heart, because when he learned that he was wrong, he repented and changed. And then we could spend a lot of time on it, and Charles touched on this yesterday, the many temptations in the area of sex. Sensuality, lust, immorality, pornography, contact with people of the opposite sex. I don't think I need to say it here, but we need to be so careful with that when we're speaking to people in our counseling, in our whatever, with sitting with people of the opposite sex. Paul writes to Thessalonians in 4 verse 3, 1 Thessalonians 4 verse 3, and he says, it is God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid, abstain from sexual immorality. And so, as I said, it's broad. One of the things of David was that he was a man of lustful passion. He loved women. He had many wives. He had many concubines. And one of the problems is he had too many to lead properly. Lust and polygamy slowly turned the heart of this king away from the Lord. As the Lord had warned in Deuteronomy that when there is a king, many wives will turn his heart from the Lord. And his lustful passion, this lustful passion in David's life, was one of the dark spots in his life that later came back to haunt him. Because even with all his wives and everything that he'd achieved, the lust got the better of him when he saw Bathsheba. Charles asked us some questions. Statistics in America, but I think they're worldwide, speak about how many pastors and church leaders have a problem in that area. God knows, and you know. Give attention to that area. Another danger is the danger of neglecting our primary responsibilities. And if I think of David again, David's primary responsibility would have been after himself, his wife. But he had many wives. And he didn't fulfill his God-given responsibility because he had too many. And so you've got to deal with it. How do you fulfill your primary responsibility? He neglected that. Then he got, what happens if you have many wives? Produces many children. And we know David wasn't a good father. So his primary responsibility he was neglecting because he had so many children because of his lust for women and sex, and he couldn't raise them properly. And then he became so involved in public affairs as being the king that his children also suffered because of that. And so he lost touch at home and he had undisciplined children and so forth. And we know that. I don't need to mention those things. Those children, Amnon and Absalom and so forth. Then there's the danger of not doing one's homework, being presumptuous and overconfident. And there I think again of David and the ark. He was so confident. He was on a roll. God was blessing him. The meetings were going well. Less and less preparation necessary because I'm in the flow. And he brings back the ark and Achan dies. Because we don't do our homework. We don't go back to the word. We assume, presume. And then God says, David, the reason why Achan died was because the way that you brought back the ark goes against my prescribed ways. Therefore, there's no blessing that came forth out of that, but death. And closely tied to that is the danger of carelessness. Paul writes to the Corinthians in chapter 10, verse 12 of the first letter, 10 verse 12, and he says, therefore, let anyone who thinks that he stands take heed lest he fall. Sin always bears consequences. And that is why we need to take care that we don't fall. Pride comes before the fall. Is it Proverbs or Psalms? Somewhere there. And then what about realizing that we are never too young nor too old to fall? And how many leaders in the Christian world, how many church leaders have fallen just in our lifespan? Just the other day in Holland, I heard of two. And influential people. And we look at Bathsheba and David. There we see how he was careless. And we say, how can this happen? Because first of all, David was ignoring the warning signs, the little light on the dashboard. And when we're driving and the little light keeps on going on, what do we do eventually? If we don't know how to fix it or whatever, we pull out the wire so the little light doesn't come on. And in some cases, it may not be a problem. But usually that warning light is there for a reason. And it's flickering for a reason. But we ignore it. And he was ignoring the warning signs. He was ignoring the fact that he had a weakness in his life with regard to women. Weaknesses that he should have dealt with, but he didn't. And then because of his many wives and concubines, his heart was slowly turning away from the Lord. And then he withdrew himself and became more and more unaccountable. And then we read in 2 Samuel verse 11, chapter 11, verse 1, in the spring of that year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel. And they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. He was in the bedroom instead of in the battle. And one afternoon, he was walking on his roof, and there he saw this beautiful woman taking a bath. I don't know if he knew that that was the time that this woman was there. I want to assume that he didn't. And that he's just innocently on his roof and then suddenly he sees a woman, which can happen to any of us. Even when we should be in the battle, but we're at home. It happens. It can happen. You're zapping through the TV when you can't sleep at night, and suddenly you come to a station channel, and it's Bathsheba. Then what do you do? Quickly zap through, or alone in a hotel room, and bored and missing, it can happen. It can happen to any of us, that flash moment of Bathsheba being there, but then what does David do? He feeds that lust of his. He's careless. He doesn't stop. He doesn't ask somebody to pray for him. He doesn't run into the bedroom. But he sends for her because he lost control. And David fell, and he fell badly. Again, I want to quote Charles Swindoll. Had David been where he belonged with his troops, there would never have been the Bathsheba episode. Our greatest battles don't usually come when we're working hard. They come when we have leisure, when we've got time on our hands, when we're bored. I want to add, when things are going well. And we've entered a season of comfort. The first night when we had to do the thing with that pipe cleaner, I noticed that we still have to pay for people who are still addicted to pipe smoking and have pipe cleaners. But, Charles. But I sat with Kevin, was it? Yes, Kevin and I, we were together. And I made the treble clef. And I said, for me, he said, are you musical? I said, no, not at all. I said, I do love music. I love classical music. I said, but we had to describe the season we're in at the moment. And I said, for me, I'm in a sweet, melodious season in the church, in in our lives, also with my wife's health. We're in that place where we're at peace. And so the first thing that came to my mind was that treble clef. But that's also the time when the dangers, we let down our guard maybe. It's a season when you're not having to fight. Oh Lord, what must I do here? What must I do there? And it's nice that we also have those seasons. But be careful. Again, to David's credit, the episode does not end there. And he falls on his face before the Lord and he says, I have sinned. And God restores and heals. So you may be sitting here this morning and you may be saying, the Spirit of God is touching my heart through this and I feel so guilty. And the guilt should lead to acknowledgement of the wrong and then repenting and experiencing God's grace and goodness. And God had a new thing for David. He didn't reject him. And receive that from the Lord too this morning. The last thing I'll mention is the danger of power, which we also see with David. He grew stronger and stronger. Then he took the stronghold of Zion in chapter 3 of 2 Samuel, or chapter 5 of 2 Samuel. And then he built a city all around from Millo inward, And David became greater and greater, and the Lord God of hosts was with him. And David knew that the Lord had established him as king. He was in that sweet season, in that melodious place. And how many times have we not seen around us and in the world and in the biographies that we read of the people that came to a place of power, and because of the power, they fell. Because then you want more. All kinds of different things. We could talk about this much longer, but be careful. Be careful. Of that that place where God has given success, of then wanting to have more and more and more. I could also mention the dangers of hypocrisy, the dangers of fear and worry, the dangers of greed, sarcasm, criticism, cynicism. Let's be careful. I don't want to make it sound like a negative thing. I mean, some of the things we shared sound negative, and they are negative in the light, but they are real. But let's not forget, the Spirit of God can speak to us, touch our hearts, and help us to gain the victory in that. For those who are facing such temptations at this place, and if you've not fallen, and realize through these things, but for the grace of God, there go I. Father in heaven, I don't stand here as one who is perfect. I am one of us. And we all need your grace. And we all need your touch every day anew. And we all are vulnerable, and all of us could fall if we do not pay attention, do not yield to you, do not call out to you to keep us in the hollow of your hand, and if we do not learn to listen to the warning signals that sometimes aren't just a small peep, peep, but a loud shout from your voice. Give us the grace to be the examples. That's one of the other points. Paying attention to the example that we are and the example we give. For those who may this morning have felt the stab of your sword, your surgeon knife, who may be reminded of something that is painful in their life, maybe in the past, maybe recent, maybe at this point, may they respond in the way as you give them the opportunity. And may they experience cleansing, forgiveness, healing, a recommissioning, as in the case of Elijah. And not perhaps necessarily a recommissioning, but just again a confirmation of what you've called him or her, me, us, all of us. In Jesus' name, amen.